Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The House Select Committee's investigation the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol building has produced history's most detailed account of an American president's cruel and seditious pursuit of power. Even now, former U.S. President Donald Trump continues to push states to alter the outcomes of the 2020 presidential election. We now present you an article written by Robert Reich. The piece is titled, Trump's Attempted Coup Continues, Even After January 6 Hearings Are Over For Now. The House of Representatives Select Committee investigating the January 6 attack has finished its hearings, at least for now. But Donald Trump's attempted coup continues. He has not stopped giving speeches to stir up angry mobs with his big lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. He gave another fiery address on Friday evening, 22nd of July, in Arizona. He's actively backing congressional candidates who propound his big lie. Donald Trump continues to push states to alter outcomes of the 2020 presidential election. Just recently, he urged Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss to support a resolution to retract Wisconsin's 10 electoral votes cast for Joe Biden. He's encouraging Republican lawmakers in several states to pass legislation allowing them to take over election machinery and ignore the popular vote. Meanwhile, the lives of committee members and their families have been threatened. Witnesses have received gangster-style warnings not to cooperate. The committee's message to all of America, including Republicans, stop supporting this treachery. The committee has made that treachery crystal clear. The committee has shown the deception behind Donald Trump's big lie, including Trump's Attorney General William Barr saying, I saw absolutely zero basis for the allegations, and that promoting it was a grave disservice to the country. It has demonstrated nonpartisan repulsion towards Donald Trump's attempted coup, even in Trump's White House. As former Trump aide Cassidy Hutchinson said, I was disgusted. It was unpatriotic. It was un-American. We were watching the Capitol building get defaced over a lie. It has made open appeals to Republican lawmakers to stop supporting the attempt. The Republican vice chair of the committee, Liz Cheney, warned her Republican colleagues, who are defending the indefensible, that there will come a day when Donald Trump is gone, but your dishonor will remain. It has revealed how average Americans fell for Donald Trump's treachery with disastrous results. Witness Stephen Ayers, who described himself as nothing but a family man and a working man, participated in the January 6th attack because Donald Trump basically put out, you know, come to stop the steel rally, you know, and I felt like I needed to be down here. And it has reminded Americans of their duties to democracy. As Committee Chair Benny Thompson put it, when you're on the losing side, that doesn't mean you have to be happy about it. But you can't turn to violence. Committee member Jamie Raskin recalled Abraham Lincoln's warning that politicians who encourage mobs to rampage and terrorize will destroy the bonds of social trust necessary for democracy to function. It is impossible to know whether the hearings will lead to criminal indictments and convictions of Donald Trump and his enablers. But the hearings already appear to have convinced some Trump supporters that he's a dangerous charlatan. The percentage of Republicans who say Donald Trump misled people about the 2020 presidential election has ticked up since last month, while Trump's enormous fundraising operation has slowed down. A New York Times Siena College opinion poll recently showed that nearly half of Republican primary voters would rather vote for a Republican other than Donald Trump in 2024. History teaches us that it is possible to bring down an American demagogue by putting his wickedness on display for all to see. In 1954, I watched the Army-McCarthy hearings. The Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy, whose communist witch hunt was ending careers and debasing much of the US government, had charged the US Army with lax security at a top-secret Army facility. The Army hired Boston lawyer Joseph Welsh to make its case. At a session on 9th of June 1954, after Joseph McCarthy accused one of Welsh's young staff attorneys of being a communist, Welsh responded in words that led to McCarthy's undoing. "Until this moment, Senator, I think I never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness." When McCarthy tried to continue his attack, Welsh angrily interrupted, "Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You have done enough. You have no sense of decency." Almost overnight, Joseph McCarthy's immune national popularity evaporated. Censured by his Senate colleagues, ostracized by his party and ignored by the press, Joe McCarthy died just 3 years later, 48 years old and a broken man. Now the January 6th Committee has produced history's most detailed account of an American president's cruel and seditious pursuit of power. But will it be enough to stop Donald Trump's ongoing attempted coup? That depends on whether Americans heed the committee's implicit plea to ensure that American democracy endures.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Emmet is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on iRib English Radio, Kalav Islam Page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. The path of servitude is full of difficulties. You have to disobey Satan and evil temptations. You must fight your evil self so that you can pass the Sirat bridge easily in the other world. As the famous Persian poet Hafez states, "At the beginning, I thought that love is an easy task. However, when it started, I recognized its complications. Love for Allah is more difficult because you have to leave behind all materialistic belongings and temptations." What makes a person successful in servitude to Allah is endless efforts to fight satanic powers. Forbearance and steadfastness are the keys to success in our path to Allah. We must not get tired on this path. If we fall down, we have to stand up again and continue our way towards perfect servitude to Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech on iRib English Radio, Kalav Islam Page, which was the English translation of a short Persian speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Kalav Islam Page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
A fortress mindset feeds the U.S. government's huge defense budget, which is higher than the military budgets of the next 10 countries combined, while the Pentagon maintains about 750 military bases overseas, says Norman Solomon Ryder in an article published under the heading, Fortress Mentality Among U.S. Leaders Has Trapped Americans in a Cycle of Militarism. Stay tuned for more. Mainstream media and politics routinely assume that the United States is a well-meaning global giant, striving to keep dangerous adversaries at bay. A fortress mindset feeds the U.S. government's huge defense budget, which is higher than the military budgets of the next 10 countries combined, while the Pentagon maintains about 750 military bases overseas. But victimology is among Washington's official poses, in sync with a core belief that the United States is at the center of the world's importance and must therefore police the world to the best of its capacity. In recent decades, U.S. military power has faced new challenges to retain unipolar leverage over the planet in the wake of the Soviet Union's collapse. Heavy is Uncle Sam's head that wears the crown. Along with the fresh challenges came incentives to update the political lexicon for rationalizing red, white, and blue militarism. Ever since, U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright gave the motto its big-time national debut in February 1998 on NBC's Today Show, efforts to portray the U.S. as an indispensable nation became familiar rhetoric, or at least a renewed conceptual frame for U.S. interventionism. She said, "If we have to use force, it is because we are America. We are indispensable nation. We stand tall and we see further than other countries into the future, and we see the danger here to all of us." In 2022, such verbiage would easily fit onto teleprompters at the highest levels of the U.S. government. The appeal of such words has never waned among mass media and officials in Washington, as the U.S. simultaneously touts itself as the main virtuous star on the world stage and a country simply trying to protect itself from malevolence. Leaders in Washington don't want the sun set on the U.S. empire, but China and many other nations have other ideas. This week, news of Nancy Pelosi's intention to visit Taiwan in August was greeted with cheers from the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, which wrote that she deserved kudos for planning what would be the first trip to the island democracy by a House Speaker in 25 years. At midweek, President Biden expressed concern about the planned trip, saying, "I think that the military thinks it's not a good idea right now, but I don't know what the status of it is." However, his team's overall approach is confrontational, risking a potentially catastrophic war with nuclear-armed China. Despite dire warnings from many analysts, U.S. geopolitical stance toward China is reflexively and dangerously zero-sum. Iran's government adhered to the nuclear deal enacted in 2015, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. But the Trump administration pulled out of the pact. Rather than swiftly move to rejoin it, the Biden administration has dithered and thrown roadblocks. 2 weeks ago, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken disingenuously announced, "We are imposing sanctions on Iranian petroleum and petrochemical producers, transporters, and front companies." In response, Quincy Institute Executive Vice President Trita Parsi tweeted, "Biden is continuing and embracing Trump's max pressure policy, while expecting a different result. All of this could have been avoided if Biden just returned to the JCPOA via X order. When an executive order, as he did to reverse President Trump's withdrawal of the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord and the World Health Organization. What continues, with countless instances of repetition compulsion, is the proclaimed vision of the United States of America leading the charge against the world's badness. Beneath the veneer of goodness, however, systematic hypocrisy and opportunistic cruelty persist on a massive scale." A case in point is Biden's recent journey to the West Asia region. The presidential trip's prominent features included fist-bumping with a Saudi monarch whose government has caused a quarter million deaths and vast misery with its war on Yemen, and voicing fervent support for the Zionist regime as it continues to impose apartheid on the Palestinian people. American leaders, they insist that an inexhaustible supply of adversaries is bent on harming the United States, which must not run away from forceful engagement with the world. But the actual U.S. agenda is to run the world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kadhim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: لا تبذل لإخوانك من نفسك ما ضره عليك أكثر من منفعته لهم.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "Do not give away of yourself to your brothers so much that the loss incurred by you supersedes the benefit to them."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we talk about the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the seventh divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, we find that the idea of remembering death and remembering the grave and remembering the hereafter are concepts and ideas and themes which are repeated by every single immaculate and infallible imam and, of course, the divinely appointed prophets and messengers of Allah, including the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. So in one gathering, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam attended the funeral services of an individual who had passed away. Now, as is in any funeral service, of course, many people had gathered around the person who had died, and they were about to lower this individual into the grave. And while the people were lowering this dead person into their grave, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam said an amazing thing. He said, "Surely the thing whose end is this is worthy of abstaining from. And surely the thing whose beginning is this is entitled to be feared." So once again, I just want to kind of take you to the scene that was happening. This individual had died and they were lowering them into the grave. And so Imam al-Kadhim says that the end of something is this death and lowering into the grave. Now, what is that thing which the end is the grave? That is the dunya, the materialistic world. And so Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says that the end of the materialistic physical aspect of this world, the end is the grave. And if the end of this materialistic, selfish, consumeristic world is the grave, then surely it is worthy of abstaining from, because it ends in the grave. But then Imam al-Kadhim says that the thing whose beginning is this death, this grave, what is the beginning? The beginning that starts at death, and that is the hereafter. That is the movement towards the ultimate day of judgment. And here Imam al-Kadhim says that the day of judgment and death and the afterlife, the hereafter, whose beginning is this death and this grave, surely must be feared,
But the fear, dear friends, is not enough. We must also work actively, ask for forgiveness, make amends, and take a new step towards Allah in order to safeguard our hereafter. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
If each and every one of us rose to the responsibility and understood from the life of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far and his companions and what he did, then our situation would be much better. What did Imam Musa ibn Ja'far do? First of all, he made sure that there was a man by the name of Ali ibn Yaqtin. Yaqtin, the father of Ali ibn Yaqtin, used to trade in fragrance, in atar. And at the time of the Umayyads, or the Umayyads, he used to come out and he used to praise Bani Hashim and curse the Umayyads. And what happened therefore was that the Abbasids, when they attained power, when they got the power, they loved him, they liked him, because he had spoken against the Umayyads. And therefore, they wanted to appoint his son Ali to take a ministerial position. Imam was approached by Ali ibn Yaqtin. Ali ibn Yaqtin asked him, Ya ibn Rasulullah, what should I do? Should I take this position or not? Imam said to him, Ala anna lillahi awliya'a fi abwaab al-zalama. Surely Allah will have friends where? At the doors that belong to the oppressors. In other words, you go ahead, yet with a condition. And the condition is, when someone comes to you, one of the believers, and requires something to be done and completed or fulfilled, you should not hesitate. And you should do it. In other words, you should facilitate. You should make things easy for people. And indeed, this is what we find that the Imam alayhi salam demonstrated. Someone came to him from Ahwaz. He said to him, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, I am in great debt. And the governor in Ahwaz is one of your followers. He is one of those who loves the Ahlul Bayt. I want you to write a letter to him. Maybe he will remove some of the loans and the debts that are incurred upon me. Imam alayhi salam writes a letter. The letter is two sentences. The letter states, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has reserved paradise for those who alleviate the suffering of their brothers and sisters. Khalas, that's it.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel has a history of either attempting to or conducting acts of terrorism in Iran. But more often than not, Tehran successfully discovers and prevents such attacks. On Saturday, Iran's intelligence ministry issued a statement saying that members of a terrorist group affiliated with Mossad were identified and arrested by Iranian security forces before they could take any action to carry out acts of sabotage. The ministry added that terrorists who were in contact with Mossad agents through one of the neighboring countries had sneaked into the country while carrying highly explosive bombs. Later, reports emerged that the espionage planned to blow up a sensitive facility in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. This, however, isn't the first time Israel had planned on carrying out acts of terrorism in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's intelligence ministry forces had also captured individuals linked to Mossad in April. The spies were involved in disseminating classified information and documents. In July, Iran arrested another network of agents while they were carrying a large cache of weapons and ammunition with the intentions of provoking riots and terror inside the country.
Earlier in March, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps foiled yet another Israeli act of terror. The Islamic Revolution Guard Corps said it stopped an imminent Israeli plot to sabotage the Fordow uranium enrichment plant.
Israel has, however, conducted a few terrorist acts against Iran over the past years, namely the murder of top Iranian scientists and army generals and acts of sabotage on nuclear sites. Yet, interestingly enough, the regime continues such atrocities without being held accountable by the international community, and more specifically the U.S., who has supported Israel through its veto power in the United Nations Security Council.
The impunity with which Israel carries out such attacks or in this case, makes such plans, is fully enabled by the United States of America, which at this point, I believe, should be deemed responsible for the crimes and the destabilization that the apartheid state of Israel engages in. The primary way that the United States enables the crimes and the destabilization of Zionism and the colonialist apartheid state of Israel is through its veto in the United Nations. Since 1972, the United States has vetoed 53 resolutions attempting to hold Israel to account by way of international law.
Israel has been involved in a string of sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities in recent years and has killed many top nuclear scientists and military officials in cowardly strikes. More recently, on May 22nd, Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodai was assassinated by two motorcyclists who shot him 5 times before fleeing the scene. He was dismounting his car to enter his home in an eastern neighborhood of the Iranian capital when 3 bullets hit him in the head and 2 bullets in the hand. While Israel has yet to officially comment on the incident or take blame, all reports and facts indicated that it has so far been behind the terrorist activities in Iran. Regarding the Khodai case, American outlet The New York Times cited an intelligence official as saying that Israel has informed American officials that it was behind the assassination. Despite all this, the regime continues its petty attempts of trying to accuse Iran of destabilizing the region.
Israel attacks its neighbors on almost a daily basis, for example, bombing Syria, whereas Iran has not attacked a neighboring country in over 300 years, or almost 300 years. Furthermore, the very well-known international human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, as well as B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, have deemed Israel to be an apartheid state, which inherently as such destabilizes the region. So there's nothing new here in terms of the Israeli and American narrative, their propaganda regarding Iran. What I do see as new and heartening is the fact that the effectiveness of this narrative is weakening very rapidly.
Israeli atrocities have also garnered fierce response from Iranian officials. The chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has warned that Iran will take a harsh revenge on those who assassinated a member of the force in Tehran.
The commander of the Iranian Army's ground force has warned that Tehran will raise Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel makes any attempts against Tehran. Brigadier General Qumars Haydari also stated that Israeli occupied territories will be liberated in less than 25 years. Russia says it might go beyond Donbas, where it once laid the lines of the conflict in Ukraine. The shift was articulated by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who said one reason Russia might expand its operation are the longer-range rockets and artillery the US and NATO allies have been funneling to Ukraine.
The geography is different now. It is not only about the DNR and the LNR, but also about the Kherson region, the Zaporizhia region, and a number of other territories, and this process is continuing consistently and persistently.
Lavrov's remarks are the clearest comments that Russia's objectives have expanded over the 5 months of war. Earlier, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Lavrov's statement confirmed what Washington and its allies had suspected were Russian President Vladimir Putin's objectives all along.
He has stated a number of times that, you know, this is a limited operation focused on the Donbas. His actions have proven otherwise.
The U.S., despite claiming that it knew about Russia's intentions, only seems to be further fueling the war through its support for Kiev. The U.S.'s military assistance has topped $8 billion, part of a $40 billion aid package. And all this while analysts view diplomacy as the only tangible solution to the ongoing conflict.
The U.S. empire's strategic aim is to expand NATO eastwards, right up to the borders of the Russian Federation, stage coups where necessary, as in Ukraine in 2014, and in the words of Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, to vanquish Russia, divide it up and gobble up its component parts, the better to march on to China. It's a hegemonic agenda, and there is no way that the U.S. will tolerate the Ukrainian government having a negotiated peace with Russia. Rather, the plan is that to drag the Russian Federation into a long war.
Washington claims to be supporting Ukraine to defend itself. Officials in Kiev have, however, suggested that Crimea, which the West still recognizes as part of Ukraine, could be a target for U.S.-made missiles recently deployed by Kiev. The remark, however, prompted a fierce response from the former Russian president, warning that an attack on Crimea will ignite a Judgment Day response. The West, led by the U.S., apart from supplying financial aid, has also imposed a wide range of unprecedented sanctions against Moscow in support for Kiev. The bans have targeted individuals, banks, businesses, and state-owned enterprises, including the oil and gas sector.
The U.S. also planned an economic war on Russia by leveling economic sanctions, which are unilateral and illegal, by excluding Russia from the SWIFT transfer system, by stealing its monetary resources stored in Western banks, and by cutting it off from its natural trading partners in Europe.
The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries, global supply chains have been disrupted, and there are fears of food shortages. But now, experts fear the situation, especially in Europe, could further deteriorate as the continent struggles to find middle grounds on solutions to the current uncertainties.
But the U.S. sanctions backfired on the West, especially on Europe, where Europe took the brunt of the energy cutbacks. And it caused the U.S. war caused an inflationary crisis for the entire world.
All this has also led to indications of fatigue settling in the EU. The Hungarian Prime Minister has so far been the most vocal about his concerns regarding the bloc's strategies on Ukraine.
West's strategy on Ukraine has failed as governments in Europe are collapsing like dominoes. Energy prices have surged. A new strategy is needed, which should focus on peace talks and drafting a good peace proposal instead of winning the war.
But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way. While standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. The International Energy Agency has even warned that a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch this winter awaits Europe, mainly due to the possibility of Russia cutting off gas supplies completely.
U.S. President Joe Biden just visited the West Asia to promote Washington's agenda in that region. Apart from encouraging Washington's Arab allies to pump more oil into the market to bring down rising energy prices, Biden, on behalf of the Israeli regime, was trying to form a coalition against Iran. But the much-publicized event failed to garner support from the United States' Arab allies. Now, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the latest plot in the West Asia region failed because the regional countries do not trust Washington. Kanani also said Iran considers the security of its neighbors as its own security.
The Saudis are recognizing the U.S. is in decline, and Joe Biden is the symbol of America's decline, mentally, politically, socially, religiously. And they have embarked on a different geopolitical, economic, military agenda, and that is to unite with the BRICS nations and seek their political destiny elsewhere than within the United States. So I think Joe Biden's trip was an absolute failure. It didn't accomplish anything, and we knew it wouldn't accomplish anything.
Just a day before the summit between Biden and the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries, plus Egypt, Jordan and Iraq, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, the Prime Minister of Iraq, said Baghdad will not be part of any camp or military alliance. He also said, quote, Iraq will not be a base for threatening any neighboring countries. The UAE, which is a close ally of both Saudi Arabia and the US, also dismissed the idea of forming an anti-Iran NATO-like military alliance. We are open to cooperation, but not cooperation targeting any other country in the region, and I specifically mention Iran. Such comments show that Biden, who has practically followed the anti-Iran policies of his predecessor Donald Trump, failed to achieve his stated objective of forming a military alliance against Tehran.
So this entire trip of Joe Biden's was a futile effort, wasted effort, and I think it only depreciated America in the eyes of other nations. And for that reason, other nations are seeking political alliances elsewhere, in other global institutions, such as the BRICS nations and the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative and other things.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman also dismissed the recent Israeli threats against the Islamic Republic as psychological warfare. Nasser Kanani says the Tel Aviv regime has neither the courage nor the capability to confront Iran militarily. He also vowed that Tehran would give a decisive and destructive response to any Israeli aggression. Iran's response to any idiocy committed by the Zionist regime would be destructive.
Not only is the United States incapable of any military conflict, but Israel is also incapable of any military conflict. And Israel is incapacitated, yet they are putting on an aura of functionality, an aura of threats. But at the heart, Israel has no capacity to wage a conflict against Iran. This is all bluff, and this trip confirms it.
Kanani's comments come in response to threats made by Israeli Army Chief Aviv Kohavi. The Israeli general has said, quote, it's Israel's moral obligation to prepare a military response against Iran's nuclear program. He also added that such preparations for such a strike are at the center of the military's program. Kohavi's warmongering rhetoric against the Islamic Republic comes despite Iran's insistence that it's not seeking to develop nuclear weapons. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has issued a religious decree against weapons of mass destruction. And just recently, Kamal Kharazi, the head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations, rejected allegations that Iran seeks nuclear weapons. He said Iran has the technical capability to go beyond the current 60% uranium enrichment level, but it will not go that path. It's an open secret that Israel is the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the region and has hundreds of warheads. The regime's officials have constantly threatened Iran with strikes on its nuclear facilities. The regime is responsible for the murder of a number of Iran's nuclear scientists. It has also carried out sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities. And its latest threats against Iran are just meant to shore up its crumbling hegemonic position.
As the crisis in Ukraine lingers on, the United States and its allies appear to run out of measures to halt Russia. They have imposed various sanctions on Moscow. Russia's energy, banking, and financial sectors have been targeted by the West. But the punitive measures do not appear to have the intended results. Now, the United States is proposing the idea of putting a price cap on Russia's oil.
This is more suicidal stuff from the West. This Western-centric, this US-centric, European-centric view of themselves as being indispensable parts of the world, I think is the main problem here, because they view themselves as the center of the universe, so to speak, in everything, in politics, economics, etc. However, they fail to understand that the world is rapidly changing.
The West is trying to limit the price of Russia's oil in order to deprive the country from the money it needs to run the war. The goal is said to be to set the price at a level that covers the marginal cost of production so that Russia would be encouraged to keep producing oil. The idea, which was first proposed by Washington, was agreed upon at the G7 summit back in June. Western countries plan to allow only those raw material and oil products whose value does not exceed the price cap. In reaction to the proposed idea, Russia has threatened that it would not export oil to the world market if a price cap is imposed. If these prices, which they are talking about, are lower than the costs for oil production, naturally, Russia will not ensure the supply of this oil to the world market, which means that we simply will not work at a negative profit. It's not yet clear whether Western nations have the capability to implement such a plan, but there are already warnings that this scheme may actually backfire. Russia's president says the price cap would further propel global oil prices, and Security Council Deputy Chairman Dmitry Medvedev has warned that oil would be traded between $300 to $400 per barrel if the West goes through with the plan.
The European markets and the US markets are not the prime markets for Russian energy supplies. The prime markets are now Asia, and so they are out of step with what is happening in the world. And what this will do will exacerbate, as you noted, an already rather tenuous energy crisis, which is caused by, on the one hand, shortages of energy supplies, and on the other hand, costs of energy supplies. Because to cap it, who's going to sell it to the West under the production cost? No one, especially when the West treats them the way that they are treating them. So, it's going to be another shot in the foot for the U.S. and its vassal and client states.
Some analysts are predicting that the scenario would be catastrophic for the U.S. and the other group of seven countries. Market watchers have predicted that China and India, two key players in the Asia region, may not cooperate with the price cap. Western sanctions on Russia have already failed to deprive the country from its revenues. They have actually increased the money Moscow makes from its energy exports. Oil prices climbed to 14-year highs shortly after the war began on February 24. They remain above $100 per barrel. According to other analysts, history shows that such attempts end in failure. The US tried to fix prices for oil in the 1970s, and the UK tried to set the forex prices in the 80s. All those attempts failed, and the prices boomed after those debacles.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, sisters and brothers. This is Asma, and I have the privilege to be your host for today's discussion. Well, here with me, I have two very dear and credible guests, Sister Zainab and Brother Muzaffar. It's been so long since the last time I met you two, and today I am over pleased to have you both in one picture. Okay, ladies, first I will start with you, Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, and how are you doing?
Assalam. Thank you so much.
I'm glad.
Doing great, alhamdulillah.
Thank God.
Totally psyched to be here with you guys.
So pleasure to be with you. And you, brother, assalamu alaikum, and how's life?
Wa alaikum salam. Life is good, alhamdulillah. And I'm here after such a long time.
And it's great to be back. Great to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
So, just as the ritual of this program, I would love you two to give me a very short introduction about yourself. And let's start with you, Brother Muzaffar.
Yeah, so I'm Muzaffar Haider. Mm-hmm. I'm born and raised in the UK. I'm studying in the Hausa, and now I occasionally show up at IRIB English Radio and discuss some interesting topics with you.
Of course.
Of course. And you, sister?
I'm Zainab. I'm a student of philosophy.
Philosophy is very interesting, though. So there are certain sort of things and perhaps activities, I don't know, skills that when we want to go and plunge into them, then we think that, okay, it's too late. It's not any longer for me. I cannot do it. And then people come with this very nice motto and they tell you, no, it's never late for anything. You can do everything at any time that you wish for. Mm-hmm. But it seems a little bit of problematic. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at your salah, for example, you mm-hmm. want to pray your prayers, you know, it might be late.
Yeah.
You know, you want to read Maghrib and it's already Fajr time. Mm-hmm. It's too late to read Maghrib. But at the same time,
although So there are some certain things that have some certain time.
Yeah.
There's a timing for everything, but then again, it all depends on perspective.
Objective. Okay.
Like even the salah thing, right? Mm-hmm. From the perspective you defined it, like,
it's never too late to read your Salah prayers.
It's never too late to start Salating.
Unless you're dead.
Unless you're dead, exactly.
That's too late.
That's like hella too late for anything at this point, except for decomposing, basically.
Yeah. It's never too late to get married, for example.
Yes.
Yes, I actually believe in that. Even if you're 90, love is still out there.
Great time for marriage.
I believe in that. I really, really believe in that. But is 90 a good age to have a child? No, I believe it's too late.
Well, you could do the test tube baby thing.
But you can't even take care of yourself anymore, bruh. How are you going to raise a child?
Poor the child.
Loads of grandchildren who could look after my child. Why would I need to do it?
Okay, so that's what I meant.
Tomorrow. So that little child is miserable. Why should I do that
exactly,
to him or
Brother
her?
Muzaffar, that's what I meant about objective. What were we saying? Like having a child, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're 90, it's no longer the time for you to have a child because we were talking about, well, I was talking about, I don't know if you guys agreed with me or not, perspective and objective. What's the objective of having a child at the age of 90 anymore?
Yes.
The child cannot bond with that parent. The child cannot relate to that parent.
They would
parent.
Not have enough of those parents.
Yes, and they would not have enough of that parent. That is so important.
Yeah.
The mental, psychological needs of that child will no longer be met by a 90-year-old, borderline senile.
That's fine. I've got a great-grandchild. Mm-hmm. Who's old enough to pretend to be that child's father.
What's the objective of... my point is, you know, the objective, the self-growth that comes with having children, the sense of selflessness, sacrifice, serving a greater objective, stepping out of your ego in order to serve another creation of Allah, all of those objectives are now out of the window.
Yeah. Let's go for a little break. We'll be back in no time. Dear audience, stay with us.